I solved a big snack problem in our household in a very simple way. My children love eating berries, and so do I, for not just the taste, but the vitamins and nutrients, fiber, all the good stuff we want on a regular basis. The problem? We all know what it's like to pick up a berry we just bought, and it's already growing fuzz in the fridge. So I've switched to buying frozen berries. And a favorite I look for now is Washington Red Raspberries. Did you know 90% of frozen red raspberries in the United States are grown in Washington State and mostly grown on family farms who harvest them during peak ripeness and clean and freeze on location, sealing in all that freshness, taste, and great nutritional value. So now I use frozen raspberries in our yogurt or smoothies as a sweet treat. And I love that this means I can support local American farmers and have a healthy snack for my family that withstands the test of time. You can find Washington Red Raspberries at your local grocery store or Costco. And how do you know you're getting the good stuff? Well, you just take a peek at the packaging and look for product of the U.S., and then you'll know you're on the right path. Oh, and if you want some fun recipes and more information, go to redraz.org. That's redraz.org. And you're going to find recipes, health tips, retail locations, everything you need to make frozen Washington red raspberries a regular part of your routine. Overall, it's just a smarter choice.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Hello, hello, everybody. It's great to have you on what is the final day, final Monday. Let's not make it the final day. We can't skip too far ahead. The final Monday of April. I was already thinking about May. See, I was already moving in that direction. And I feel a certain amount of responsibility to talk about May because I think in the professional world, and it doesn't even matter professional world or otherwise, we just don't say things out loud that everyone else is talking about, maybe in your own community, that could be really helpful. If you're a business owner, if you're wondering what happened to your friends and family, like what's actually, you know, happening in the world. And what I mean by that is that I now know because my son, my eldest is in third grade, I started to get like this kind of mid-April, I was getting this anxiety. And, you know, we have a lot of stuff going on in our household. There's a lot of different moving parts. So I thought maybe it was that. And I said, no, it's not that. It is that, but it's the fact that we're almost in May. And there needs to be a public service announcement for May. Because if anyone has family that's involved in any portion of academic life, I'm saying kindergarten to graduating college or beyond higher degree, this period of time is especially stressful. And I wish someone said to me when I was a younger person, hey, listen, you're on a team where you have moms and dads. They got a lot going on. May is going to be tough. Like just a heads up, that they're suddenly going to be called to school for no apparent reason to pick up their child midday just because there was a half day. Or they're going to be required to be at school for some sort of festival or field trip. And although that's joyful, it's going to be interrupt the regular workflow. Or there's going to be a graduation, people are going to be traveling. I feel like we all need to come together for May. So I'm going to start that on Smarter News, that as we edge into May, that way we could just give each other a little bit of grace. Grace is always good. But particularly in May. Is anyone on the live chat agreeing with this today? Let me just see. I see Tawny saying, yes, May is almost worse than December. Yes, Tawny. Yes, this is what I'm talking about. Claire also agrees. All of last week, I kept thinking we were at the end of May, not the end of April. Oy vey. I'm with you, Amanda, Tess, everyone agree. Thank you for your support. I feel like this is really important. We just give each other like a little bit more space and just a little bit of understanding. I don't know if that applies to world leaders or people that are in leadership positions where we're going to actually demand things of them on a regular basis, but kind of important to know. I think this is important. So that's, I just wanted to make sure I got that public service announcement out of the way, and we will make that a tradition now on Smarter News. And maybe we can even share ways to make May a little bit easier. My birthday's at the end of May. I was actually born on Memorial Day weekend, usually when Memorial Day weekend hits, May 30th. So I'm not asking for any gifts. You don't have to mark your calendar. It's okay. Birthdays do change as you get a little bit older, but that's all I thought about as a young person, right? You know, we get out of school and it's going to be my birthday. That's what my focus was. And now I'm like, oh, I was so sadly wrong about that. So I'm going to correct the wrongs of previous years. I'm really excited about today's broadcast because we have a lot of different stories to talk about today, like a smattering of a lot of different stories that I think really can matter. And so I'm really going to try to stick to the quick, concise, nonpartisan information. I know sometimes I get talking to you and I just love it. So I want to share all the things, but I'm going to try to get through a variety, a cornucopia of different news items that I think are actually really important as we edge into May. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about just as we get started in this week, because I'm sure you've seen it over the weekend, is some of the really severe weather that we saw in certain parts of the country. This weather pattern that produced a lot of severe thunderstorms as well as some massive tornadoes really produced these, quite frankly, just stunning video and images from Mother Nature. And no matter how many times you may see this in your lifetime, it's just unbelievable to see some of it in front of you captured on video, you know, a tornado coming across the road. And sometimes it's easy to divorce yourself of the actual impact of the storm because it's so, when I say awesome, I'm not saying that in a positive way. It's so kind of overwhelming to see nature behave in this way. As we move into the week ahead, we expect some more severe weather patterns. If you're traveling, you have things going on, I think it's important to know about that also because it's good to have a heads up. One of the things I didn't know about tornadoes as I entered into kind of this world of reporting and journalism is tornadoes can happen anywhere. They can happen in all 50 states. And I want to contrast that to hurricanes. Hurricanes tend to happen in a certain part of the country. There's hurricane season, which is June to November, thereabouts, the hurricane season that we pay most attention to, at least in the United States. But tornadoes are really different. Anywhere, all 50 states could potentially have a tornado. Yes, it is true that we tend to see them more in Tornado Alley. And let me go ahead for those of you who are joining us live. I'm going to pull up a graphic for you that's going to show us Tornado Alley. What's important to know about Tornado Alley is it actually was a term that was developed by the media. This is not a technical scientific term, although maybe meteorologists will use it. Tornado Alley is really going to refer to the central part or the Great Plains, you know, Nebraska, Oklahoma, the northern part of Texas. These are areas where we see a great deal of tornado activity. But what's also interesting is that although there is a feeling about the science behind what creates a tornado, you know, you have cold weather and hot weather, you have thunderstorm environments. What is the exact mechanism of a tornado is still a little bit of a mystery. And so again, this is why you can see tornadoes suddenly appear in areas where maybe you didn't expect it. Brooklyn, for example, the Northeast. So it's good to be aware of that because I think if I was living in California where I was born and I saw a tornado warning pop up on my phone, I would think, yeah, that must be mistaken. That's not going to happen here. We don't get tornadoes here. The reality is that it actually can happen here. Let me introduce you to someone that we reference quite frequently without actually giving him due credit. And this is a scientist from the University of Chicago. His name is Tetsuya Fujita. He was known as Ted. He was born in Japan. And he came over to the United States where he continued a lot of his work. He was really focused on tornadoes, meteorology. And he's the person that developed what we refer to now as the EF scale. It's the Enhanced Fujita Scale. And this is the scale that we use to measure tornadoes. It's named after this man. There was first the Fujita Scale. Now it's the Enhanced Fujita Scale. And this will give us the rating. So when you see E3, E4, E5, this is all referencing this scale, and it is around this mystery of how do you explain the strength of a tornado. With hurricanes, it's based on wind strength. That's how we measure a hurricane, you know, category 3, 4, 5. But with a tornado, it's a little bit different because they can come up suddenly and you may not only have that with that wind speed. Wind speed is a factor. But what the scale does is actually look at destruction on the ground. And if you look even closely into it, and you can access it very easily online, it's almost like a checklist of what is actually seen by meteorologists. And that's why it'll take a day or two for us to get assigned a certain measurement for a tornado. Even this morning, I got up really early to start writing out Scoop, which is our newsletter that's actually delivered along with this report accompanying this video to our insiders online. And I didn't see a measurement yet. Several hours later, there was a measurement that's being used more for one of these tornadoes in Oklahoma. So it takes a little bit of time, and that's determined by the National Weather Service, by actual meteorologists that are going to be qualified to go on the ground and say, okay, this is what we're seeing, and this is the destruction that we're checking off. One of the interesting things I saw in this, in how this is looked at, is it's not, for example, just about like how many trees are felled. Are the trees all falling in the same direction? And that direction is going to tell us something about this being a tornado versus being a storm. It's very fascinating. It's also a reminder in this time period. And I know we've all been through this pandemic together. I'm going to talk a little bit about scientific uncertainty in a second on an unrelated issue, that we do have mechanisms to try to make sense of what we don't No, you know, we're trying to put a number to Mother Nature that we're just developing so we can explain it a little bit better. Exact science looks different now post-pandemic than it did before, at least to me as a journalist, where I would state as a fact, well, this is an EF3 tornado. This is an EF3 tornado, which is built on an estimate by a scale that we've now all agreed to use. But this is also limited. It's also limited in the number of decades that we can compare research to, because it's a relatively modern scale to look at this. It's a reminder how quickly life can change and how certain communities can be changed in ways that will take them years to recover. I was thinking about this more broadly related to the U.S. economy, because as I was thinking about tornadoes not having a season, I was reflecting about how we are going to come up to hurricane season this summer. And you have one major disaster that could really impact a certain part of the country, that could also impact, let's say, the energy markets or the economy there and have more broad sweeping effects, let's say like Hurricane Katrina. That could be a factor in the election that we're not even thinking about right now. And so it's a reminder about how these things that you think are not connected at all can be connected and in unexpected ways. We did get some news late last week that was reported as expected, meaning that we knew that we were going to get a reading on GDP, but it was sort of quiet. There was a lot of things going on last week. We had some big developments regarding the case of former President Trump in New York City. We had the Supreme Court hearing on presidential immunity. There was a lot going on. So this GDP reading did not get a ton of news outside of the business world, and this is why I wanted to flag it for you. GDP is a reading on the economic health of America. Every three quarters, we're going to get three different readings. There's a first reading, second, and a third. So there can be revisions. What we got is the first reading for the first 3 months of the year. So this is like our report card. Like, how good did the U.S. economy do at the beginning of the year? And the big headline from this is that the U.S. economy is not growing as fast or as robust as economists expected. It's not growing anywhere close to what it looked like at the end of last year. Now we have to leave a little space because that's a holiday season. So a lot of people are shopping, lots going on. And this is raising some more concern about just the overall health of the U.S. economy. While we're not seeing the term recession being used, again, that would be negative growth. So we see like a negative reading. We're not seeing that. We are seeing some more reporting about stagflation. What's stagflation? Stagflation is when the economy is growing really slow, inflation is still pretty high, and usually there's high unemployment. Right now, we're not seeing high unemployment. So it doesn't exactly fit the bill right now, but you're seeing this conversation take place. Stagflation is difficult to get rid of. Once you're in that high inflationary environment, we're still seeing inflation fairly high, and you're not seeing really robust economic growth, it could be tough to kind of move the economy along. And we have a couple other factors that could really impact this. Let me just show you this. This is a graph coming from the U.S. Bureau of Economic Analysis. It's going back to 2020. It's a bar graph, and you can see where we are in the first quarter of 2024. We're barely in positive category. You can also see what happened during the pandemic, where we had hugely negative reading during 2020, and then a huge rebound. And then we saw some growth after the pandemic. Again, this is more during the recovery. And then the last, 2 years or so, we've been moving along, but haven't seen robust growth. So this is something I think is really important to keep an eye on. The head of America's largest bank, JP Morgan Chase, his name is Jamie Dimon, had an interview with the Wall Street Journal. And I thought you'd find it interesting what he said about what he's seeing as a head of a large bank and the U.S. economy.
The consumer's in pretty good shape right now. Unemployment's under 4%. It's been there for 2 years. They still have excess money from COVID. If you go back to looking at the amount of money that was spent during COVID, it was $6 trillion. That basically went into consumers' pockets through various means and various programs. They're still spending it down. If you look at the bottom 50% of income, they pretty much spent the excess, so they're kind of back to where they were. The top 50% still has excess. Housing prices are up, stock prices are up, jobs are plentiful, wages are finally going up at the low end. The consumer's in pretty good shape. Because of that, business is in pretty good shape too, because people spend, it creates profits. The one thing you got to be cautious about, a lot of it is driven by just fiscal spending. Mm-hmm. So even today, the deficit is 6% of GDP, almost $2 trillion. That's driving a lot of this growth. And that will have other consequences possibly down the road, called inflation, which may not go away like people expect. So when I look at the range of possible outcomes, you can have that soft landing. I'm a little more worried that it may not be so soft and inflation may not go away people expect. I'm not talking about just this year. I'm talking about 25 and 26.
So very interesting comments coming from CEO Jamie Dimon of JP Morgan Chase, because he has been a little trepidatious about what's going on with the economy. And what he's talking about is just the amount of government spending that's been pushed into the U.S. economy. And by the way, we can talk about that predating current government. It's not really specific to Democrats or Republicans. There's just been a ton of spending. If you look over the last couple of decades, if you push that much money, remember, if you put a lot of supply into the economy, what happens when you have a lot of something? The value of it goes down. So when you have a lot of dollars going into the economy, what that dollar can end up buying you goes down. That's a higher inflationary environment. And so he's talking about something that's fairly complicated, but also just good to be aware of, which is, what is the way out of this high inflationary period? Because we want to make sure that our money actually buys us what it should buy us, not less than what we want it to buy. So it's something that I want to pay attention to, especially after seeing what was the CBS poll that came out. CBS News was talking about how people and voters in key swing states are not feeling good about the economy. They're looking back in the years before the Biden administration as better than perhaps they were, because remember, the Trump administration was through the pandemic. So we saw those wild swings through the Trump administration. But it seems that according to these polls, you know how I feel about polls, I want to be very careful with them, but I thought this was interesting. People are not associating the pandemic with President Trump. They're clearly associating it with this something else. Perhaps an anomaly. They're not associating it with any of the policies of that administration. So they're thinking about the past in a different way than some of the data showing it, and they're feeling more negative about the present. And so I'm curious what you thought about Jamie Dimon's comments about, consumers feeling pretty good. Do you feel that way? Because it's how you feel that's actually the hardest thing to capture in data that can actually have the most impact on how people vote and the sort of decisions they make, which affects the economy here in the United States and the global economy overall, as we're the biggest economy in the world. So some things to think about there. One of the major factors in inflation, and that was not talked about, that had nothing to do with policy and had nothing to do with the pandemic, was actually the bird flu. The bird flu in 2022 was the deadliest outbreak of bird flu in U.S. history. Could have missed it easily. We saw that prices went up in the grocery store, but all the prices were going up. So we didn't see it as necessarily egg specific. And in the case of 2022, when we're talking about the bird flu, we're talking about birds. And when you have a flock of birds that are infected with the bird flu, farmers have to kill the entire group. That it's so infectious and they don't take any risk. And that obviously affects poultry prices and egg prices because you're just, again, pulling something out of the economy that the economy was depending upon. So that was a major issue. And it was because eggs, poultry are in so many different things, this was also adding to this heavy inflationary period in food prices, again, for a completely different reason. Well, as you know, and as we've been talking about, we're seeing bird flu now in cattle. And this is a little bit confusing for our scientists and researchers because there's a question about how exactly is that happening? You know, cattle are eating hay. Are they coming? How are they coming in contact with infected birds? What sort of wild birds could these be? How? What is going on here? But if you look at more broadly the story about bird flu, look at all the different animals where bird flu has been found. It's difficult to say birds because we're not going to talk about birds here. Seals, bears, foxes, skunks, cats, dogs, tigers, leopards, goats, and cows. This is where bird flu has been found. There's been a big question about what's going on with cattle herds in the last several weeks. Cattle herds in several states are being infected by bird flu. This was affecting milk production specifically. And there was a question about, well, does the pasteurization process kill the virus if you have cattle that are giving milk and that's going into the commercial milk supply? Well, we actually have a development. And let me see if I can pull this up here from the FDA. I just saw this as we were moving into our broadcast, and I wanted to read from it directly because there was a little bit of mixed signals last week. The reality was that the FDA was able to test for the bird flu in milk. And what they were doing is we're all familiar with this term now. We've all grown a little bit, right? PCR testing. We knew that there was genetic material of the bird flu in commercial milk in some of the tests. Because there was genetic material or fragments of the virus, we didn't know, is it live virus or is it dead virus? That seems like it's probably an important question, right? You think, listen, I may not be worried about bird flu because right now we don't see it in humans very frequently. There's very few cases. And in those cases, these people came in contact with infected animals, an infected bird, or recently, an infected cow. We have not yet seen in the United States spread between person to person of the bird flu, but something we're watching for. And remember, there can be suspected cases of bird flu that are not hitting the data yet. We really have to leave room for that. So here's the FDA update, though, from Friday. So the FDA has received, I'm reading from it, has received additional results from an initial limited set of geographically targeted samples as part of its national commercial milk sampling study underway in coordination with the USDA. The FDA continues to analyze this information. What it goes on to say is that the pasteurization is effective in inactivating the virus, the bird flu virus. This additional testing did not detect any live infectious virus. These results reaffirm our assessment that the commercial milk supply is safe. However, the FDA is further assessing, I'm paraphrasing here and I'm reading directly, I'm kind of skipping over just so you know. I want you to know when there's a direct quote. Here's the direct quote. The FDA is further assessing retail samples from its study of 297 samples of retail dairy products from 38 states. So here's another line. Subsequent results will help us to further review our assessment that pasteurization is effective against this virus and the commercial milk supply is safe. So I have some questions for the FDA, and I'm going to be writing them today because I think this is really important. You know, what could the possible risk be? If you're saying that we believe the commercial milk supply is safe, like, do they think that you could actually get bird flu from drinking infected milk? Does anybody know that? Have we tested for bird flu in seals, bears, goats, and cows anytime before 2024 or 2023 or 2022? Do we have the context to compare this to? Have we been drinking live bird flu virus for years and not really knowing it? I mean, these are some things we need to understand what we're comparing it to. But in addition to watching the commercial milk supply, guess what? We're seeing bird flu cases increase in poultry again. And so are we in a situation where we're seeing some cattle taking out of milk production? In some cases, we're seeing for the first time that some of the cattle are being destroyed. They're being killed because of this. We know what happens to the birds. They are normally killed if there's an infection. what is that going to do to food prices if dairy products are impacted and egg products are impacted? This is a really important story to watch, especially as we're moving into the summer and into the back half of the year. This is potential to affect all of us and perhaps the larger economy overall. We're going to be steady on it, but I don't want to miss it. How many egg-laying hens do you think there are in the United States? This was kind of a freaky fact I learned about. This is from CBS. 313 million egg-laying hens. There used to be 316 million. So it was talking about how the bird flu has affected supply overall. That's a lot of, those are only egg-laying hens. Hopefully they don't revolt against us. They got numbers, you know? So that's something we really have. So again, this is something that I want to keep an eye on. I don't want us to be caught flat-footed. You know, do I see anything that's cause for alarm? Not necessarily. Am I seeing a drip, drip, drip of information over the last several weeks that makes me say, huh, how much, what do we really know about this? The answer is yes. And I'd like to know some more about it. And I want to make sure that you're aware of it too. If you have any questions about that, or if you are in the dairy farming business, a poultry business, I'd love to hear from you. This is very tricky, and this can really affect family businesses too. We don't want to forget that. So it's something that I'm going to be watching very closely. Interesting. Jessica's asking here, any impact on beef or just dairy? Great question, Jessica. Haven't seen anything yet. And it's a question that I have for the FDA. So we're checking the milk supply. And I guess, again, very remedial knowledge of what it takes to be a cattle farmer. Clearly, there's cattle farming that's going to be dairy milk production and perhaps cattle farming that's going to be for beef production. Great question. These are the unknowns. So just want to give you a heads up on it again, because I think it's important. All right, let's zoom out a little bit and talk about international affairs just really briefly here. We're going to kind of tie it to some of the big questions that all of you had about Title IX and also about campus protests that are happening around the country. But first, I just want to give you kind of a broad view as we're going into the Middle East this week. We have the Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, traveling. He's in Saudi Arabia today. He's going to be in Israel. He has made more than a half dozen trips to the region. There seems to be, and we always have to add this caveat because we're getting reports and sometimes the media is being used as part of the negotiations as both sides are posturing. We know that there's negotiations ongoing between Israel and Hamas. These negotiations have not been fruitful so far, but there was a question about a change. If Israel would consider a more sustained period of calm if more hostages were released. And there was a question of, is that similar to saying the fighting would be over, the war would be over, which is something that obviously Prime Minister Netanyahu has not made any public declaration about. Is it an opening, though, for perhaps negotiations to move forward? Is something that we should watch for. Secretary Blinken was speaking at the World Economic Forum just today, very early in the United States. And he did an interview that crossed a lot of different ground, China, the Middle East, all of it. He was asked specifically a question about campus protests. And what's just unfortunate, I was actually watching this live around 5 o'clock Central Time. The part of his answer, his full answer, was the only part of this whole presentation. He's on a large stage where the volume went in and out. So unfortunately, I don't have the full answer. But he's asked, you know, what do you make of what's happening on college campuses across the country as far as protests because of the Israel-Hamas war? This is the part that I was able to grab that I actually feel does sum up, because I heard a little bit of what happened before the volume got choppy, and I thought you would find it interesting. Here's Secretary Blinken.
I don't hear anything said about Hamas. I don't hear anyone reflecting on the fact that, obviously, the atrocity of October 7th never should have happened, but once it happened, everything could have been over in an instant. If Hamas had stopped hiding behind civilians, put down its weapons, given back the hostages, and surrendered, none of the suffering that we've seen since would have happened. So, where is the demand on Hamas? There's been silence. It's almost as if it's been erased from the story. That's something that I think we also need to reflect on. Even as I say, I profoundly understand the deep emotion that people are expressing, whether it's on our campuses or other places.
Widely speaking, the secretary is correct in that the protests that we're seeing on college campuses are not focused on Hamas. They're actually focused on Israel, at least at this iteration. We want to leave some space because we know that protests have been happening on college campuses since October 7th, since the terrorist attacks took place in Israel. We've seen different groups with different interests, sometimes competing interests, come head to head on college campuses. But what we're seeing right now is an effort by protesters to do several specific things. These are some of the specific asks of protesters on college campuses around the country right now. In general, yes, there's a protest of the war taking place, but specifically, the ask of protesters on college campuses is that the colleges, which in general have large endowments or large funds that they're using to invest to help the financial stability of the school, not invest in Israel or Israel-related ventures, and also not invest in defense-related ventures that could be enabling Israel in its war against Hamas. I have a couple of photos from different colleges all around the country, and I thought you would find this interesting just to see, because you could see these are coming from the University of Texas, Austin. This is from UC Berkeley. This one is from Stanford University. This next one is again from Berkeley. We have another one coming from Stanford back to Texas. We know, obviously, Columbia University is wrapped in here. Here's one in Georgia. So these protests are widespread. They seem different. Right. Anecdotally, they're getting a lot of attention. They seem different. We look at this particular picture. It's been difficult to articulate, though. Why are they different? And there's actually a University of Texas professor, Dr. Stephen Mintz. I might be actually promoting him. I'm looking here, Professor Mintz. We reached out to him because he wrote a really interesting piece that one of our members of Smarter News flagged for us. And it was entitled "From Draft Cards to Hashtags, the Changing Face of Student Protest from the 1960s to Today." And he goes through this whole list of different ways that the protests this time around are different than the protests in the 1960s. And he puts words to feelings that, as I read it, I thought, oh, I didn't know how to articulate that exactly. Why this feels different? Why does this feel different? Why is tension so high? Is it just because it's an election year? Is it just because it's the Middle East? Is it just because for the first time we're seeing protesters mass in this way? In this particular image, you're seeing most of the protesters are completely masked. We didn't see that before the pandemic. So is that just a holdover from the pandemic? And is that giving protesters a different feel or look? Like, what is going on here? So I'm going to put this in our show notes, because if you're interested in this, I think it's a very fascinating observational look at the protests without a lot of editorial. He's looking at it from an academic perspective and comparing the 1960s to what's going on right now. This is number six. And this I thought was really important to point out to you. And I'm going to read directly from his work. Many leaders of the campus protests during the 1960s sought not to simplify, to disrupt, but to build public support. That concern with coalition building outside the campus isn't as apparent today. Coalition building was a goal of many of the leaders of campus activism. They actively sought to extend their influence beyond academic settings to engage broader public support and drive societal change. The dynamics of coalition building in the 1960s contrast with many of today's campus protests, which sometimes appear more insular and adversarial, often even hostile to reporters. And he goes on in this particular section to even reference Martin Luther King Jr. and how this idea of nonviolent protest, but protest mattering as a way to build empathy, to bring people to your side, to be convincing. Yes, at times to be disruptive, but you were doing it to get attention because you felt so strongly you wanted people to join you. It was about getting people to join you rather than being just adversarial. He was saying the priorities of these protests seem different. Now, again, this is his observation, but I thought it was an interesting one. If you ask the question, are these campus protests about driving societal change, or is the intention to be adversarial for these particular demands rather than getting public support? It's an interesting question, probably one that we can't answer, but I'll be curious your thoughts on that. I did have a question that I am curious about as these protests continue. And it's because of probably my anxiety as a student over finals, but also just just a personal anecdote. You know, I was born and raised in San Francisco, California, very, very close to Haight Street, where obviously the Summer of Love took place and you had these massive war protests. And my parents were in school during the 1960s. So I remember asking my mom, hey, did you ever go to a protest? I was just curious. She was at San Francisco State University. There's a lot of protests. You know, we got the Summer of Love, we got Flower Power, we got all of these things. Like, mom, were you part of it? I'm just sort of curious. And she said, no. She was the first person in her family to go to college. She worked to pay her way. She's like, I didn't have any time. I didn't have the money to do that. Like, I had to work. I remember her saying, I had to work. Despite how passionately I might feel about these subjects, I had to work. And so I'm thinking about some of these protesters are students. They do have finals. And some of these students also have rents. So how exactly are they able to set up shop on campus? And there's been some thinking as to, you know, organizations that could potentially support them. And I don't have any blockbuster data here. I was actually working off a report in the New York Post, but I wanted to show you this particular group and this particular map, because there's a question of like, well, how big are these protests? This is the National Students for Justice in Palestine. Again, the United States does not recognize the country of Palestine. This is part of the question of a two-state solution. Should there be a country of Palestine and a country of Israel? And how does that get set up in this current environment? So this is a particular group that is supporting what they're saying is supporting almost over Palestine solidarity organizations across occupied North America. They use a different term for that, but just for ease, North America. You can zoom in on their map and you can see all the different protests that are taking place and these little tents that are set up to signify basically an occupation, right? That and I want to use that term, I'm using it because I'm thinking about Occupy Wall Street or different protest efforts in the past where people stayed and camped. And in these campuses, that's happening in certain campuses. Now, certain campuses aren't tolerating it. In certain campuses, they are. But a look at this map that, again, I'll put in show notes for you, gives you an idea of just how widespread it is. If you believe that if it feels like these campus protests are a lot of different places, that's because they are. They are in a lot of different places where there's a lot of high-profile universities, especially across the Northeast, where you have a density of population. Also across the West Coast, you have less in the middle of the country. But again, we're looking at densely populated areas versus not. Obviously, different style of schooling in different parts of the country as well. And so this gives you an idea of just how widespread these protests are. There's a big question in my mind of how long will they go on, in part because of resource. And what happens if there is a change in the direction of the Middle East? Does that affect some of these demands of these protesters, which could quite frankly predate the war in that they're focused on Israel rather than focused on the war or perhaps Hamas in these particular situations that we're talking about? So it's something that I think we have to continue to watch and one that we'll see what changes, because there's been a momentum for more of these protests, not less. Notable though, however, Google was confronting dozens of their employees protesting in some of their sites in New York and in Silicon Valley. These protesters were arrested. There was an investigation and more arrests were made. And paraphrasing the Google CEO, he just said, we're not going to tolerate it. You're here to work. Appreciate your thoughts. You're here to work. We're not going to be disruptive to the work environment, and took a very strong stand. That's not very typical of Silicon Valley. That can be a little bit more sympathetic to, you know, social justice movements, more progressive thinking. I think that's notable. It's a huge company. There's zero tolerance. Will other companies follow? Will that set a standard perhaps for universities? We'll see. It's going to continue. Speaking of universities, we had a great question come to us on Title IX. And I really appreciate your voice memos. Title IX has made some news. We have so much news over the last several weeks. And I wanted to make sure we did the proper research on this. But this is a question that many of you have had. And so I would like you to hear a member of Smarter News reflect that.
Hi, Jenna. This is Lucy Clay McGee in Tallahassee, Florida. I was just curious to know more about the recent Title IX changes that have been made. I have a daughter who two daughters that are in middle school and high school who play sports, and one who potentially could play in college, possibly. So I'm just curious how this affects Title IX as it was originally intended for, and now how it's going to be changed. Thank you.
Very interesting. I'm sure you've seen some headlines on this about some sort of change that the Biden administration made on Title IX. What does that mean? Lucy, thank you so much for your voice memo. I really appreciate it. That's hugely helpful to us to also hear your voice and hear your concerns. And obviously, with two daughters, Title IX is a major government law that came about in the 1970s that was really focused on equity for men and women on college campuses, specifically on college campuses that receive federal funding. You know, equal opportunity, equity in a lot of different areas. We talk about Title IX related to sports because of there's been a huge investment, obviously, in male sports over the years, male education, quite frankly, you know, several decades ago. And so it was, how do you get this more equitable for women and women athletes on campus? Okay. So what happened is the Biden administration released some updated policies regarding Title IX. And Title IX is a law, but different administrations can talk about how this law is going to be applied. There was a smattering of all sorts of different headlines that talked about what this new update to this law meant for the LGBTQI+ community. I'm reading directly from the policy. All these reports are going to center on this one paragraph that I'm going to read you. And this is under the heading. It's a 4-page document. Again, we'll put it in show notes. The bold part that we're going to focus on is prohibit discrimination against LGBTQI students, plus students, employees, and others. He goes on to say this: the rule prohibits discrimination and harassment based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics in federally funded education programs, applying the reasoning of the Supreme Court's ruling in Bostock versus Clayton County. That's it. That's what it says. Okay. What is that Supreme Court ruling? The Supreme Court ruling is from a couple of years ago. It was talking about employment discrimination. It was not talking about sports, college campuses, anything like that. It was saying in an employment situation, sex discrimination extended to gender identity, homosexuality, and it was a larger umbrella. It's not just male, female. That discrimination can go into those different, it could be considered under that umbrella as well. Again, in a work situation, the Biden administration did not need to cite their reasoning for this update about prohibiting discrimination against LGBTQI+ students, but they did as sort of a way to say, see, we're following and I'm interpreting this. This is my interpretation of this, of like, hey, we're citing this as an update in law. We're following this. There's a question about how much it actually applies here. This is how they're citing it, though. So there was a lot of news that has come out that said this is going to enable transgender athletes to compete in different sports. It's going to empower transgender athletes to use different bathrooms. You probably have seen these headlines now coming out that states are saying, we're not going to follow this new Title IX. I, too, was searching along with a member of my team. I'm so grateful for her. You know, what was specifically said about this issue? There was nothing said specifically about those issues that I just mentioned. It's only from this paragraph that says the rule prohibits discrimination and harassment based on sexual orientation, gender identity, and sex characteristics in federally funded education programs. So this is not in effect. It's going to go in effect before the next school year. The question is, and where we're getting to some of these headlines about transgender athletes and where they're going to be able to compete and where they would be able to use the bathrooms and what would that look like, is how exactly will this discrimination update be applied? Can an athlete say that they want to participate in a certain sport and the school is discriminating against them under Title IX and this specific paragraph, and therefore the school is going to be legally liable for that and not receive federal funding? Do you see how this is? I'm trying to connect the dots. So it is an update that includes LGBTQI+. It is an update that says it's prohibiting discrimination and harassment based on these new categories. The question is, how exactly will that be applied in different situations, in different schools, and be challenged? And can these schools be challenged legally if they do not allow, let's say, a transgender athlete to compete in a certain sport or use a certain facility? So it's setting up the potential for legal challenges. What those legal challenges are going to look like, we don't know. In what states, we don't know. So when states come out and say, we're not going to follow this, that's all well and good. They don't want to follow it. That's their prerogative. Can a student still challenge a school that they're in based on this update? Of course. And it's up to the course to decide if that legal challenge can move forward. Is it likely that we'll see legal challenges? For sure. For sure. We'll likely see legal challenges. And it'll be a different scenario and different situation. And then the parameters are going to start being changed. And schools will start changing their behavior depending on these legal outcomes that could be, you know, several years in the making. This update was also a response to the Trump administration. They made some changes to Title IX and how, for example, harassment claims could be made. And so different administrations can come in, and although it's the law of the land, they can talk about how this law is going to be applied based on the policy of that administration. It's a little bit tricky. So it didn't require a congressional update. And this is where there's some gray area. So what I would say, if you see these headlines about what this means for women athletes, I'm not saying those headlines are wrong. I'm saying these headlines are what people are considering are the outcome of this. What that actually looks like in reality, we're going to have to wait and see. We'll have to wait and see. It's also a misnomer. I saw one headline that said this has nothing to do with transgender athletes. No, that's not true. I mean, this absolutely can be applied to transgender athletes, but they didn't specifically say transgender athletes, and they didn't specifically say these athletes have to be able to compete in any sport and use any facility, or the university's on the wrong side of the law. It didn't say that. So you see, this is a great example of how the media jumped on this. And there's a lot of important voices to consider, but in reality, we're going to have to wait to see how it plays out. Barbara's asking, does that wording seem intentionally vague? Great question, Barbara. This is it. Barbara's a regular Scoop member. I appreciate you, Barbara. You're always here. This is something I didn't want to forget, and I would have forgotten it if you didn't say it. This wording made conservatives really angry. And this wording made liberals really angry too. Conservatives were angry because in some cases they thought this is opening the door to something they don't believe in. In this case, it would be a transgender athlete competing in a certain way using a facility in this particular example. The more liberal thinking or progressive side was angry it was not more specific, empowering those specific examples and saying, if you don't do that, that's discrimination. So it was viewed as lukewarm by both sides, not specific, meaning that it was dangerous in some cases. Again, I'm summarizing here, dangerous to one side in some cases and not empowering enough in the other. So it was actually both. And so it was very, and yes, I would say this, none of this wording is going to get by with not a lot of copy editors and policymakers. So yes, I would say this wording is general. You could use the term vague. It opens the door for potentially some legal challenges. So we'll see what happens next. We're going to have to wait. And Megan saying here, it seems like it just fuels the fire of this issue. It's a good question to ask. If this wasn't an election year, or let's say the Biden administration is elected for a second term, if this language gets more specific, we won't know though. We're dealing in hypothetics, and you know what? We got a lot of hypothetics in our life. We're on the verge of May. We got a lot of things going on. So we're gonna leave room, and we're going to see what happens. But it's not into effect until, really the beginning of the next school year. So we'll see what takes place. I saw a couple of good questions I just wanted to make sure I address before we leave, just based on, again, this article from Professor Mintz. Martha Kay was asking, well, this is regarding the campus protests. Are we sure the protesters are college students, or could it just be protesters that have decided to take over college campuses? This is a great question. It's one that many college campuses are looking at. Are these actually students, or are these organizers? And how do you tell the difference? And who's allowed on campus? And what does that actually look like? Private institutions are, as we heard from the NYPD just last week, private institutions, they're responsible for their own security. So you have to invite the police in unless you're using your own security in this particular case. It's a great question. One of the things that Professor Mentz talked about, again, going back to his work, is one of the sea changes was in the protests in the 1960s, college professors were not as politically active. And now we're seeing that there's more ability for those in leadership roles to get more involved on college campuses. I thought that was an interesting point that I don't think I would have thought about. The other question that I saw come up here was about whether or not the entire college campus, how much of the college campus actually agrees with the protesters. Again, something that Professor Mintz talks about, and that it's very difficult to see how much it reflects. You know, are we talking about a small percentage of the college campus when everybody else is just trying to go to school? And it can be very difficult to discern what does that look like. He did say that in the 1960s, some of the views of protests on college campus were very overarching. For example, we're going to march for peace. We're marching for peace. We're not marching for a particular affiliation. And he said that's a marked difference, where the protests that were taking place in decades prior had these not larger, but maybe more inclusive. So you could say, yeah, for peace, I'm going to join in that protest, where these are very specific demands, very pointed protests. It's not, these are not large overarching. It's very specific, and that he thought that was a difference of what we saw as far as trend lines and protests and college campuses across the United States, not just now, but in previous years. So again, very interesting piece. I hope we have him on. Maybe when he gets through May, he literally wrote us that. We come full circle. He said, I'm so sorry. I'm so busy with the end of semester duties. I cannot do this interview. And all of us at Smarter News were like, we totally understand, but we hope to have you sometime soon. See, it's happening to all of us. So I think we did a good job. We can honor his work. This is about 10 pages long. So, but this is big print. So I printed it up. So I don't think it's 10 pages long if you like to read through it, but I thought it was very curious, and I still have some questions about what's going on to college campuses as the semester winds down, finals are over. Does this change? Do the encampments move on? Do they stay through summer? What does that look like? So we have some questions ahead of us, quite a few, in fact, as we look through the economy, what's going on with the bird flu, what's happening in the Middle East, what's happening when it comes to policy and law on college campuses across the country. It's been great to see all of you. I really appreciate those of you who joined us live. It's great to have your questions and to be able to address them right away. If you'd like to join us live, remember you can join us at scoop.smarternews.com. We'd love to see you. It's a great way to support Smarter News. We're so appreciative of you. And we're going to have updates on all these stories and so much more on our website for quick, concise, nonpartisan information, smarternews.com. All right, guys. Hope you have a great week. Stay safe out there with the severe weather. Keep those questions coming. If you have one, you're driving, you're walking, you're talking to a friend. Heck, you send us a question as a group. We'll take all of you. Voice memo it, send it in. We have some great questions we couldn't get to this week. We'll get to next week. So we really appreciate that. And you just email us at scoop@smarternews.com. All right, guys, have a great day. I'll talk to you soon. And thank you again for your support. Bye. I'll see you soon. Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan Smarter News. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news, and we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop, to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop, to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.